KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Kevin Kelly, author of the book What Technology Wants, which is a book that came out last year that received quite a few terrific reviews from people who I respect. And the book focuses on this idea of what technology needs in order to serve its ideal role. It's a very interesting concept that gets at how we interact with technology and how technology shapes what we do. Now, that's a topic that, of course, we've discussed with countless guests on the show. But this idea of technology having wants and needs is something that we haven't explored directly, although in chatting with people like Larry Lessig, as well as technologists like Eric Davis, we've talked about how technology itself can be shaped and what the ideal role of technology is. In What Technology Wants, Kevin spends quite a bit of time surveying a variety of fields, heavily focusing on science and biology in particularly, looking at how technology has impacted everything from the growth of human population to our thinking about the songs that we listen to. And because the book has this wide-ranging analysis of what technology actually is and what technology actually can be, it is a very interesting read, but also a book that we can only plumb really the proverbial tip of the iceberg in the hour format that we have on Hearsay Culture. But I'm very excited to have Kevin on, who is joining us via Skype from his home in California, and we are recording the show on July 8th. By way of background, for those who aren't familiar with Kevin, he was the editor and publisher of the Whole Earth Review. He helped launch Wired Magazine and was its editor for almost 6 years, and has been involved in a number of events around technology, including the Hackers Conference, the online community The Well, which I had read about when I was messing around with Commodore 64s back in the 80s. He's written several books. He's also been published in all the major media outlets, including, of course, Wired. And he's quite well known in the field and someone that I'm honored to have on the show. So I'm excited to have Kevin on. Without any further introduction, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
It's a privilege to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Kevin. Let's start off with a question that I ask all of my guests. And like I said, there are many listeners who are familiar with you and with Wired. But for those that aren't familiar, perhaps you could talk about, and you talk about this a bit in your introduction of the book, the genesis of your interest in technology and your background.
I was a hippie. I grew up in the 60s. Graduated from high school in 1970, and decided that college was really not for me. I tried it 1 year, I dropped out. I went to Asia, kind of with a lot of other people, roamed around the Indian subcontinent and other related places, Thailand, Japan, not seeking enlightenment, but trying to get a self-education. And being a kind of a hippie, I owned very little, a backpack and a sleeping bag, and I was sort of interested in keeping technology at arm's length. I eventually returned to America, rode my bicycle across the U.S. as a way to see the country, got some land upstate New York, built a house from scratch, cutting down trees, moving fieldstone. I became a beekeeper. So I was, I was sort of somebody who was trying to drop out of the technological world. And I was very enamored of the Amish, whom I met riding across the U.S. In Pennsylvania. And that was sort of maybe where I would have been. But what happened was in my traveling, I became interested in other cultures. I started writing about travel. I got a gig as a travel columnist for New Age Journal, a magazine, kind of a New Age, obviously New Age magazine. And through a close encounter with a friend at the Holworth Catalogs, which to me was sort of the Bible of the hippies, told you how to do everything yourself, which I took to heart. I got an invitation to one of the first online worlds, the first online system in like 1980s, early 80s. And I had a revelation. I had a change of heart. I had an aha moment where I saw that the people, the communities, the something that was growing and happening online when people were meeting virtually was very powerful and reminded the kind of gift economy, the kind of sharing, the way that people were sort of exposed, and also at the same time the way that they were empowered by connecting their most kind of the smallest, most obscure interest in finding comrades and doing things. All of it sort of struck me as kind of like an Amish barn raising. It was a different side of technology. It was much more humane, much more organic. And I started to write about the online world as if it was a foreign country, kind of like another travel piece. And I would go to these emerging corners and describe the culture that came, that was born from this technology. And because of that, I started to have a different view of technology as a whole, and in a certain sense, kind of redefining what I thought technology was. And that was sort of the beginning of my kind of continuing love affair with technology.
And it's interesting, you mentioned in the introduction of the book that your earliest interaction with technology, when your family got a television when you were around 10 years old, was one where you found yourself rejecting the technology. Can you talk a little bit about that earliest point?
Yeah, I'm not really sure why television never really clicked with me. It still doesn't. We don't have a TV in our house still. My kids have grown up. My kids grew up without TV. Of course, you know, I have Netflix. I was one of the first Netflix subscribers and very early in Netflix streaming. And so in a certain sense, we have the content in a certain sense, but we don't have the form. And then I think there was a characteristic of television that felt to me to be very demanding and bossy. You had to watch it at certain times. You could only watch certain things on the schedule. Of course, it was completely penetrated and soiled, in my opinion, with ads. Which, you know, if you strip away and just look at the best ads on your own terms, like, you know, on the Super Bowl at the end of the year, they're kind of interesting, but they're also very they're very disruptive, and I found that whole kind of combination of the persistent yelling of the ads and the kind of bossiness of television to be a turnoff, and I was much more of a book and magazine person. So I felt that to find out who I was and what I was good for and why I was here, I needed to be away from TV. And so I never did have TV. I kind of, you know, was traveling around without it, obviously. And when I settled down, I didn't have it either. And but I found something else in the internets, in the kind of the first choice nature of online world, and the way in which it is two-way and participatory, and the way in which you can share, and all of the many things that now we see as a virtue, I felt in it in this earliest embryonic stages that there was something really powerful and, for me, life-changing there.
And, you know, and I'm curious, just as a quick follow-up, when you say the internet, do you now find yourself drawn in by video and flash players and whatever we call the analog to television that runs through the internet, or do you have the same visceral reaction to that as you did to television as a boy?
No, not at all. And I think that's the point, is that I never objected to the content per se. I mean, we as a family watch TV, but we watch it on DVD. And it turns out that some of the great TV shows, when stripped of commercials, put onto high resolution on a screen at your own timing, it's actually an entirely different media. So we went through, watched Lost, in a very short time period, watched the whole 6 seasons, and it was basically, you know, it was 100+ long hour movie,
mm-hmm.
and it was fantastic. I don't think I could have stood it watching it, you know, week to week, and stuffed with commercials. We've watched other things in that same way. It is a different media presented in a different way when you have your first choice and you have all the other. You can stop it and go to the Lostopedia and go deeper and watch it on a big screen. So I find now the new media is really, I mean, in a certain kind of curious way, movies have been dethroned as the center of our culture, which it was. And they had replaced books, but now actually it's YouTube clips. I mean, my son, who has choice of watching things, his first choice is not actually to watch a movie, is to watch YouTube clips.
Mm-hmm.
And recently we had kind of a weird parenting moment where my wife calls my son in to get off the computer and come watch a movie. I was like, oh my gosh, that's so weird. Would you get off that computer and come watch a movie with us? And so it was like, all right. So I think that short YouTube clip is the first place that this new generation is going for everything, recipes, how to program. I mean, things I would never have dreamed would be in a video format is now the answer to everything. How do you play an instrument? You don't get sheet music. You don't get a book. You go to YouTube. You watch how people play in the fingering. That YouTube clips are the center of the culture now.
And which leads us, of course, into a question of what we mean, or what you mean, by the title of your book, What Technology Wants. And I'll segue by asking you, as part of that broader question, is watching Lost stripped of any outside content, be it marketing or even delays, what technology wants? Is that what YouTube is? So what does that title mean, and is your example of watching Lost without these interruptions what technology wants?
So one of the issues that we have with technology is in English, the word means many things. Many things. So we have specific technologies like, you know, I don't know, nanotechnologies or laser technologies. And then we have the very generic broad sense of, you know, a technological society. And so I want to talk about technology in its broadest sense. And so the equipment that we're using right now that you are listening to, whether it's speakers or a computer or an iPod or a radio or an iPad, any of these things require hundreds of other technologies to make them work. So electricity requires hundreds of sub-technologies to make copper wire, to generate electricity, to meter them, to produce the telephone poles or the underground cables. All this stuff is dependent on hundreds of other sub-technologies, and each of those require hundreds of sub-technologies. So the thing that we pick up in our hand, the iPhone, say, or a light bulb, or your shoe, actually is a node of many interrelated and codependent other entities. So it's sort of a networked entity in that sense. It cannot stand alone. It cannot be made individually. We could maybe 10,000 years ago, one person could make a stone hammer. But you take a mouse, which is sort of the same size as the stone hammer, the same shape, the electronic mouse. No single person can make that. Even 100 people could make it. It takes an entire system to make that. And that's what I'm interested in. I'm into that sort of the very large ecosystem of technological things, almost like a kind of like a super organism of all these technologies and the way that they're co-dependent upon each other and even in some senses recursively dependent. So, you know, it takes copper wire to make a motor, and it takes a motor to make copper wire. And so you have these things kind of bootstrapping and feeding upon each other. And I'm interested in that very large system. And so what that very large system, if we look at the characteristics of all the technologies in the world, we put them together in this one large thing, I call that large thing the technium, to distinguish it from just individual technologies. And I think that technium, that technology as a whole, has a behavior that's very, very, very similar to the behavior of life as a whole, evolutionary life, to the process of evolution as it moves through through time. And so it's sort of like it's like the biosphere in a certain sense. It's like all life together forms this very large, self-regulating, kind of a stable and persistent system over time. And the technium is the same thing. And I ask the question, what are the biases in that technium system, the system of all technology? And the biases, to answer my own question, the biases are that it has the same biases that life and evolution have. And I'm not saying that your iPhone is alive. I'm not saying that your shoe is alive or the car is alive. I am saying that the entire system of all these things together does have lifelike attributes. It does have an evolutionary direction. It does have shares so many things with life that I suggest we can think of it as sort of the seventh kingdom of life.
And you know, it's interesting you make these points because it leads to something that you address in the book and that I wanted to discuss a bit up front. We're chatting with Kevin Kelly, author of What Technology Wants. You claim to not be outlining or discussing a supernatural force, but at least the words you're using ascribe a certain spirituality or otherness to technology that we don't normally use in that kind of language. We don't normally use in connection with technology. So how do you distinguish between what we would generally think of as supernatural or spiritual forces in technology and the ideas that you are discussing in What Technology Wants?
Yeah, that's a very fair question, and I use the word, of course, want. And most people would assign or assume want is kind of a conscious, deliberate, intelligent act. But I'm using want in a different way, in the sense we might say that plants want light. Now we vary, you know, if they lean, they grow towards the light. We can say we want light. Or you know, your dog wants food, or a grasshopper wants a mate. We understand that there's an agency to that, those systems of the grasshopper or the ant or the plant, even though they're not conscious or aware or intelligent, there is an agency. And I'm using that same I'm assigning an agency to the system. I'm saying these kinds of systems have agency. They have some agency that's not present in the parts, but is present in the collective whole. And that's scientific. That's not woo-woo. That's not new age. That's just demonstrable, provable, quantifiable fact that very, very large systems can exhibit behaviors that the sum of the parts do not have. And, you know, beehives or ant colonies again and again can kind of show these things. The memory of a beehive itself is greater than the duration of the memory of the individual bees. And so you have you know, it's kind of weird, right? So the bees are only alive for 6 weeks, but the memory of the hive can extend for years, and so mm-hmm. there is a sense in which there is an agency that's not present in the individual parts, and that agency is the agency that has this desire, this need, this urgency, this movement that I'm trying to describe. And it's not supernatural in the sense that we can measure it. It is verifiable. It is falsifiable.
And with that idea, and you mentioned this idea of the technium, it leads me to get into some of the details of the book, but particularly I think your broad view, and clearly what came out to me through the book is an optimistic view, or perhaps idealistic view of technology is increasing, and this is quoting you, the options, choices, and possibilities of others when it finds what you call its ideal role in the world. Now, there's some ambiguity there because in fact, there could be technologies where the ideal role is something that is not necessarily positive for humankind, which leads me to the question of how that works. In other words, what does it mean for technology to find its ideal role in the world, and is it always the case that they increase the options, choices, and possibilities of others if they do?
Yeah, so I propose a theory to technology. Before Darwin came along, there were plenty of field naturalists and biologists, and they were very interested in the real the world of living things. And they would collect, they would make these huge collections of things, and these collections were just one organism after another because there was no organizing framework for understanding the living world. There was no theory. Darwin came along with a theory of natural selection to explain why we saw the things we did. Well, we have the same kind of a case in technology in the technium, is that until recently, we've had no theory of technology. It's just one thing after another, one invention after another, lasers and nano bricks and, genetic therapy and, anti-gravity shoes, whatever it is. It was just one thing after another. And, I'm suggesting that there's a theory, and that actually the theory is an extension of the very same theory of evolution. And the reason why we can extend the theory of evolution into the technium is because 50 years ago we had this amazing discovery, the most amazing discovery of all, that changed our understanding of the world, and that was that the essence of life, you and me and the plants and the cows and the daisies out there, the essence is not energy, it's not matter, it's not carbon. It's information. Evolution and life are an information process. And, of course, that's what the technology is, too. It's just the rearrangement of matter that we put intelligence into. So there is an equivalency, an extension of life into the technium. It's all information processing. And so I ask the question, we can understand technology and where it's going and what it means by looking at what the long-term trends and meaning there is in evolution. And when we do that, we can see that there is kind of a continuum. It's just extending what evolution started. And those long-term trends of increasing diversity, increasing complexity are present in technology, and that the best way we can understand what the technium is about is to understand that there are trends that run through the living world and run through life.
To push back a moment, and not on the theory, but more on the need for one. There's obviously a lot of concerns among a variety of technologists involving things like privacy, vis-a-vis information shared through the internet. We have concerns about piracy and the sharing of information on the internet. And indeed, we have increasing concerns about how people use technologies in ways that might not be beneficial if it's a teenager sharing information that that an adult wouldn't otherwise theoretically share, although obviously we've seen recent examples from elected officials even question that, to broader concerns that people might have regarding sharing bomb-making technologies. All of these ideas, though, and these concerns are concerns that we've addressed perhaps piecemeal, but at least there have been attempts to address them, some successful, some not, some well-conceived and some not, without a unifying theory. So there are those that might say that we're doing just fine without having a holistic view. And with that, and I'm not challenging the need for it, but I'm curious to get your response, which I guess leads to the general question of what do you hope to contribute in terms of how we use technology by viewing technology in this way?
So it's very clear if we take kind of a biological view of the technium, which is what I'm sort of suggesting, and we look at biology, and it's really kind of like we should be shocked because, you know, death is sort of the norm, and there's pain, and there's suffering, and there's dismemberment, and you know, there's natural extinction, and it's not utopia, and actually I'm not a utopian either. I'm a protopian in the sense of that I believe in slow progress, which is what we see in evolution. So there are problems. When a new invention comes along, there will be almost as many new problems created by that new invention as new solutions, and so they will be these problems that we have that are technogenic, that are created by the technologies that we've made. And there might be a tendency to say, well, that means that the technology is neutral. And here's where I think I can contribute something to our understanding. I'm saying, no, it's not neutral. Technology is not neutral. It's not neutral in the same way that we don't say, oh, a baby is neutral, or life is neutral, or thinking a mind is neutral. No, we say all those things are good. A baby is good. Life is good. More life is better. Mind is good. More minds are better. These aren't neutral things. These are positive. And the reason why they have a positive charge is because they increase and bring choices and options and possibilities. And that's, in the end, what technology does. Even though it brings lots of new problems, it mostly brings us new choices. So we have the choice to use it for harm or for ill, but that new choice did not exist before the technology came, and that's what the technology is bringing us. It's constantly introducing and bringing to us new choices, and that's why it's good, and that's why more of it is better. So if we have a technology that causes harm, which, you know, DDT sprayed on plantations of cotton, environmental disaster, okay, that's a problem, or the issues of privacy are the problem, or nuclear radiation in a power plant, those are problems. But we answer those not with less. And so it's sort of like an idea. I think of technology as sort of like an idea made real. If I'm here telling you some bad ideas, you would not counsel me to stop thinking or to think less. Mm-hmm. You would say, no, the answer, the proper response is to think better, is to have a better idea. And I think the same thing with technology. If we have a technology that causes problem, the proper response is not less technology. The proper response is better technology. And so I think what we're trying to do is to make better technology, and there will be problems, and those problems will give us opportunities to invent new choices and possibilities. And very slowly over time, we accumulate slightly more possibilities than the year before. We never move to any kind of utopia where things are fine, but every year we have a few more choices and possibilities than we did before, and that is why technology, the technium, is good.
We're chatting with Kevin Kelly, author of the book What Technology Wants, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope you can continue to listen to KZSU as well as to Hearsay Culture. So Kevin, to get to that point, and I want to get into some of the points that you make in the book, and like as I said in the introduction, we can only delve into some of them. But in light of what you just said, you know, part of how we've thought, or at least many people have thought about technology, is this end-to-end idea, right? You know, the idea that the smart activity, the creative activity, occurs at the end of the network, and that the vast middle of the network, how you get from your computer to another computer, or any other end-to-end point, is in fact dumb, and is in that sense neutral. Is that theory wrong? Is that not how it should be? Is that not how it is?
Yeah, I sometimes this approach or the framing for this is called dumb networks versus smart networks. And I think maybe what you're asking is there anything in the course of the Techtian that suggests which way technology wants? Does it want sort of dumb networks where it's kind of the bits flow through without much being changed and all the intelligence happens either at either end? Or is this something where we start to embed a sophisticated processing in the middle as things are transmitted along?
Sure.
I don't think that there is, as I looked at long-term trends in the Techtium, I don't see it answering that question either way. The long-term trends are towards greater complexity, so things will become more complex. In the sense in which making things smart in the middle may be more complex, then it will go in that direction. Another long-term trend is to increasing diversity and increasing specialization. So whatever tool we might imagine today, we can be safe in imagining that there'll be more specialized versions of it in the future, no matter what it is, because that is the general long-term trend. And so in the sense that we have a dumb network now, we could say, well, in the future there'll be more specialized networks and some of them may be smarter. And so I would bet in that direction. And they may be more complex, so I would bet in that direction. So I think I'm talking myself into suggesting that I don't think that having only dumb networks is going to be where we'll stay in the future. They will probably be at least the options in some of the areas for having smarter networks. They may not be the predominant one, because if we think about life on Earth, most of the life on Earth is dumb. It's primitive. It's microbial. It has not become more sophisticated. The kinds of sophisticated life that we identify as, you know, on the nature films, like giraffes and starfish, even are a small percent of the total amount of life in the world. And that may be how we go with networks. Is that maybe most of the networks are dumb in that kind of microbial way, simple, rudimentary. But there are, you know, a small percent that are very sophisticated and smart. But, you know, they may give us, that may be the character that we associate, even though that's not the bulk of it. So that seems to be the way we go. Our own brains, by the way, are primarily very reptilian, very, very dumb. And that the layer of consciousness that we have and identify as humans is actually only a very small, thin layer around the top. Yet that's what characterizes our thinking, is not the bulk of it, but what we do with that small additional diversity.
If it's true that I don't hear you challenging the end-to-end theory as much as I think I hear you saying that it's only one way that technology can operate ideally. And assuming that's the case, it leads to what I think is a big question from your book, and a fascinating one, which is how we know a given technology's, or how we would determine a given technology's ideal role. As yes. Human beings, how do we figure that out?
Okay, so the direction of evolution, and not just evolution, because evolution's built on another cosmic force running through the universe, which is self-organization. So We have stable galaxies which spin for billions of years in exotropic state, which means that they're building up order over time. They're increasing the complexity of atoms. You know, suns generate heavier atoms, or stars generate heavier atoms from lighter atoms. They're increasing order, and those heavier atoms will self-organize into planets with self-organizing atmosphere, at least in this case, which over time makes a self-organized life, which self-organizes into mind. So there's a long strands of continuous self-organization that run through time, and what they're always moving towards, and the technology and the tech team are just the latest incarnation and acceleration of that long process. What they're all moving towards is increasing choices and possibilities. And so what propels, or what we can count on, what the ideal state is, if you want to align yourself with this 3.7 billion year process, if you want to align yourself with it, you align yourself to those technologies that increase choices and options, and you shy from those that don't. What kinds of things don't? Like weapons, all right? So weapons, anything can be weaponized, and what you do is you use this to destroy and take away choices and options. So there's the converse of that. You could think of unweaponization or peacefication or conviviality, which is the word I use. When you make and express a particular technology with more convivial aspects of it, you're increasing those choices and possibilities. And those are the things that over the long term are aligned with this long-term growth. Those are the ideal. And one of the things we know about communication technologies is that it's particularly convivial. It really does seem to want to open up possibilities. It can be abused. Any technology can be weaponized. Any technology can be abused. And the more powerful a technology is, the more powerfully it will be abused. Somebody will abuse communication technologies and social media. But that doesn't take away from the fact that it is inherently much more convivial than it is. It can be weaponized, but in its convivial state, it's aligned in the direction that we see evolution and the technology moving. That's what it wants.
We're chatting with Kevin Kelly, author of a book, What Technology Wants, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Kevin, we have about 15 minutes left, give or take, which is what I call the unfair portion of the show, when I ask questions that you perhaps cannot answer in the time that we have left. And I do want to talk about this point you made at the beginning, which of course is counterintuitive, which is your the time you spend with the Amish, and as you talk about in the book, the internet is Amish in character. I'll leave it at that, because obviously that's counterintuitive, at least it is to me. How is the internet Amish in character?
Well, my attraction to the Amish comes from the fact that they are minimizers. They are not anti-technology at all. That was the kind of the big revelation to me hanging out with them, was that they were really hackers in many ways, and they have this rule set which they have self-adopted, but they are always hacking around the loopholes and the rules, and they loved technology. It's just that they were very, very selective about it. Actually, it turns out that even we and you and I and the listeners are selective about what we choose, because there's just too much to choose from. We have to be. But the Amish are unique in the sense that they choose collectively as a society. There's a collaborative choosing. And I was interested in how they chose, what technologies they wanted. And they had a very explicit criteria for what they were trying to do, what they were trying to optimize in their choices. And they were only using technologies that would bring their family together and allow them to have a family-run occupation. And the test, the litmus test for them was they wanted to be able to have meals with their children every day of their child's life. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Mother and father and family would have a meal together, so, which meant that they had to work at home as a farmer or a mechanic, and their kids worked with them. So this was so any technology that would allow them to do that was good. They accepted. And any technology they found that went against that, they rejected. And so they would try to minimize the amount of technology in their lives, and which to that set that worked for them. And I actually am very sympathetic to that. But the reason why I'm not Amish is because they are only doing half of what technology wants, which is, yeah, they're minimizing their lives for leisure and society satisfaction, for support. But what they weren't doing is they weren't increasing the choices for others. They're actually parasitic on the larger society, the Amish. They don't make their own metal. They don't drill their own diesel oil. They don't, grow their own seeds. And they're not inventing new things. There are no doctors or lawyers or Amish inventors. They require us to do that. And so I tried to follow the Amish in some senses of trying to minimize the amount of technology in my life. But I'm also trying to maximize the number of choices that others have to choose from to minimize. So that's the half that the Amish aren't doing. They aren't trying to make as many different technologies for others to choose from, because we need technologies to actually find our particular genius. Mozart needed the piano or the harpsichord to share his genius, and Hitchcock needed the technologies of the cinema to find his genius. But imagine if Mozart had been born thousands of years before we had made the symphony or the harpsichord, what a loss that would be to him and to us. Or if Hitchcock had been born before the movies had been invented, what a loss it would be. So we have an obligation to try and find the technology for those children, boy or girl, some Shakespeare born today, that's waiting for us to invent their technology, just as we've benefited from the people who invented radio and iPods and the alphabet and publishing for me and you. And I think if they were Amish, they wouldn't get them. But we are obligated to increase the amount of technology in the world so that we can increase the choices, so that there's at least the potential for every person born and yet to be born to find the technology that would unleash them and their genius. And that's what technology wants, is this increasing choices and possibilities.
Without getting too spiritual and adhering to your admonition in your book, is in fact that very concern spiritual in nature, in the sense that where does that obligation derive from? What is the basis, in your view, and perhaps I'm asking you on a personal level, from where do you derive the obligation, the desire to work in that direction?
I think we all want to be part of something bigger than ourselves, and I think this kind of long arc of increasing self-organization, of increasing choices and freedoms and free will in the universe, which was kind of began at the Big Bang, runs through life, it's passing through us and it's going to go beyond us, that long arc of increasing choices and possibilities and options and opportunities and free will is something we can find greater meaning in our lives if we align ourselves with it. And I think we all wanted to be working on something bigger than themselves. And so I think as we make stuff, or as our job is to sell stuff or to market stuff, sometimes we get kind of, I don't know, wrapped up and maybe a little concerned that we're just sort of feeding the consumerist monster and making crap that nobody really wants or that will not be around for very long. And that all actually may be true. There is a consumerist kind of engine at work. But I think at the same time, as we're making all this stuff, we have to remember that we're actually participating in this long arc of something bigger, which is that we may be selling stuff, we may be just marketing stuff, but we are actually involved in trying to increase the choices and opportunities. And that, I think, I would call it a spiritual dimension, in the sense that we're moving, it's moving not to an end point, it's moving out in a direction, and that direction is greater complexity. It's moving towards sort of infinite complexity, infinite diversity, infinite specialization, infinite sentience, mindfulness, infinite changeability. And that thing, that very large thing, is something way, way beyond us, is something that I think excites us. And we can give it all different kinds of names, but that is something that we're moving towards, that life is moving towards. It means more life, more mind, more choices. And I think that's something we can get excited about moving with.
Kevin Kelly, author of the book What Technology Wants on Hearsay Culture and KZSU FM Stanford. Kevin, as we think about this on a looking forward, but also in current debates, you know, one of the major debates that is ongoing is the idea of net neutrality, the concern that the network itself needs to have certain values, that is the internet, certain values associated with it in order to continue to be a medium for vast communication and sharing of information. Is the net neutrality debate, as you see it, ultimately a debate about what technology wants? For those who aren't familiar, you can describe the debate briefly. But is that really at the core of the debate that's ongoing, or should it be?
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of whether particular technologies are easy to participate in, whether they're centralized or decentralized, whether they're controlled by corporations or nonprofits, whether they are opaque or transparent, those are what I would call the kind of the species expressions of a technology. And they make a huge difference to us in our appreciation and our devotion to it. But in a certain sense, they're not really crucial for the long-term development of it. So I think the web or the internet was inevitable in any case. Whatever galaxy or planet that you want to go to visit a civilization on, once they invent electricity and communications, they will at some point have and go through the period of having an internet web thing. But whether it's opaque or transparent or run by a national government or world government or by ad hoc hackers, none of that is inevitable. That's the kind of choice we have. And so I think in terms of whether this system is open or closed and stuff, we actually as a society have choice in it. It's not inevitable. I don't think it necessarily is what technology wants. What technology wants is to have everything connected to everything else. It wants to increase the complexity of those connections and the diversity of those connections and the specialization of those connections and the ubiquity of those connections. But the other issues, I think, I think there will be different ways to do it, and none of those are necessarily what technology wants.
As we think about this in the remaining, you know, 4 minutes that we have or so, what do you see as the needs of technology today? If you were to design that ideal role for technology, what would it be?
I think what technology needs is for us to accept that whenever there are problems made by previous technologies, that we need to engage with technology in order to try and have it express the most convivial version of it for us. So what I'm preaching is that we cannot escape more technology in our lives. More technology is better. And what we want to do is embrace technology in order to try and discover those forms of it that work best for us in our particular society. And so I'm preaching an engagement rather than what's often preached, which is called the precautionary principle, which says we don't accept any technology until it's been proven 100% safe. That's ridiculous. There are no 100% safe technologies anywhere, ever. Everything has a risk. Everything has problems. The only way we can kind of sort those things out is by using the stuff, working with it, re-diverting it, relocate it, and by understanding that the solution to technologies that don't work so well is not less of them, but more better ones. And so it's kind of looking at technology through the eyes of technology itself, understanding that we ourselves are technological. We're completely dependent on technology as a species. We've made ourselves and domesticated ourselves. We're going to become ever more dependent on it. And so we need to embrace technology and its gifts and its penalties, knowing that we're going to become more technological, and that's sort of inevitable.
Are you hopeful or optimistic that we as a society can make that kind of judgment?
Yes, I'm incredibly optimistic because if you look, and that's because of history. History is progress is real. We are much better off than we were 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, and we know that because everybody is going in the same direction, which is they're moving towards increasing choices and options, which is what we get in cities. That's why people move to cities. That's why nobody's going back to live in a village with very little technology. Even the Amish are not going backwards; they're going forwards. They have more technology every year. So we know that progress is real, and if we admit that and acknowledge that and work with that, that gives us great optimism that there's a slow incremental pronoia, a slow incremental protopia where we have a little better. Every year we're creating 1% more than we destroy. We destroy a lot. We're horrible and make lots of mistakes and lots of bad stuff. But if we can create 1% more than we destroy every year, 1% compounded over centuries is civilization.
Kevin Kelly, author of the book What Technology Wants, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture and taking the time today. I do want to ask you in closing, though, since you are quite active, what next projects are you working on at the moment?
Well, it's pretty clear that paper publishing is going away very fast. It's a not a very efficient way to disseminate information. Everything is moving to the bits and electrons and display screens, the screen in general. However, the economic models have not been sorted out yet, and I am as rapidly as possible trying to go to digital first for everything. And trying to right now, as I do that, to figure out what the workflows are, what the economic models are that would be self-sustainable. It's not clear, but it is inevitable.
Well, once you have some clear ideas on that, which of course, you know, I certainly welcome you to discuss them on Hearsay Culture, and I look forward to reading them in whatever medium exists at the time that we do that. But Kevin, thank you for joining us today, and I should mention, of course, your website, kk.org. Is there anywhere else where people can go to learn more about your work?
That's the best thing. I have a little blog called The Technium on kk.org where I continue to post stuff as I discover what technology wants.
Thank you much for joining us on Hearsay Culture, and I invite you back. I enjoyed the conversation, and thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to mention a number of guests coming up for the remainder of this quarter on KZSU's schedule. Among them are Professor Lewis Hyde of Kenyon College, author of the book Common as Air, Professor Marcus Boone of York University discussing In Praise of Copying, Professor Susan Shirk of the University of California, San Diego, editor of the book Changing Media, Changing China, and Professor Helen Nissenbaum of New York University discussing Privacy in Context. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. The best way is live on KZSU Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time, which you can also stream if you're not in the Bay Area at kzsulive.stanford.edu. Or you can pick up the show by podcast by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, or by getting the RSS feed at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to Hearsay Culture's webpage at hearsayculture.com. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at Dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.